part 5 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stephen Heller entitled Aleister Crowley, Pioneer and Experimenter.
I will begin very briefly with another little few elements of Golden Dawn magic and their explanation, which was written quite early in the game. For instance, about the alleged, or let's say traditional objectives of Solomonic or evocational magic, although of some other forms as well, and their interpretation. In traditional magic, one of the objectives of magical evocation always stated is the finding of hidden treasure. And I suppose that particularly in earlier times of history, people were wont to hide their goods in various places, in their fields or underneath their houses and so forth, to save them from the depredations of invading armies. And there weren't any banks and any vaults, and for the greater treasures, no Swiss banks either. So that was a pretty popular pursuit. You might not even be aware that the founder of a very important religious tradition here in America, in fact, probably the only large religion that was founded here in America, namely the Church of the Latter-day Saints, their founder and prophet Joseph Smith, when he was a young lad, primarily earned his living and caused some excitement in his native New England and upper state of New York by way of ceremonial magic, where he was trying to find hidden treasure. And I would say that he must have found something, because look what came of it. However, in the Golden Dawn tradition, at least one of the explanations for that was that magic can bring up data and facts from the unconscious of the human being. A second, which sounds terribly ominous, and I'm sure that no one in the Golden Dawn had really taken it literally, is to destroy one's enemies. I would say that this pertains much more to the heads of various governments nowadays who operate that way. If they don't like you, they destroy you. There are quite a few like that around in the world. However, the explanation for that was that to destroy our enemies is to realize the illusion of duality and to facilitate union within the magician, within the individual. It's interesting to note, for instance, that C.G. Jung, who was not of the Golden Dawn tradition, although I'm sure he was aware of it, said something very similar about the myth of Cain in the Old Testament, that Cain, the murderer who murders Abel, is sometimes understood as one who, by rather violent means, establishes union, destroys a duality. Another magical boon gained by evocational magic traditionally is said to have been to learn the language of animals, which certainly would probably be interesting, because sometimes one observes these various cats and dogs that are in profusion in our cities, and one wonders what they are saying. Although I'm sure that if we found out, it might not be all that valuable. Nevertheless, here also the interpretation is to a large extent that we need to learn the language of our instincts, of our animal self. And another gift that people were striving through magic, which I'm sure is connected with some of the earlier ones, is to obtain riches, which in the Golden Dawn tradition is interpreted that your capacity for work and for business may be stimulated, which I'm sure came somewhat as a letdown to those who thought that they could just obtain riches without having to do anything for it except magic. And the last one being to heal, and of course grandiloquently in medieval lore also to bring the dead back to life, was interpreted that yes, abnormal states of the body may at times be corrected, and that the involved tissues, that is written there, brought back to tone in obedience to currents started from consciousness. Now, this was written quite early, before the teachings of psychological teachings of Freud and Jung and people like that became generally known. And who do you think wrote those interpretations? Edward Alistair Crowley. So I would say that at least and to begin with, this person did have a rather fine psychologically toned interpretation of the principles of magic. As far as, let's say, the tradition emanating from Crowley is concerned, I can point to two events in my life which pointed in that direction and which sort of gave me a little personal insight into the tradition and the followers of Crowley. The first of these occurred about 1959 or 1960, when two people, man and a woman, one of them, the gentleman, became pretty much of a friend of mine for a number of years afterwards, the late Louis T. Culling and Mika Aldrich, the lady, came to me, and after several cups of coffee and conversation, they revealed to me that they came with a bold plan, and the bold plan consisted that rather young at that time, I should be sort of the front man for reviving Crowley's order of the OTO, which at that time was pretty much dormant. And I told them, you know, that friends, you know, I'm very flattered. I was reading some Crowley at that time, but that really I don't think I would be either qualified or interested in doing that. And Louis Culling said, oh, well, says, I'll give you the training, I'll give you all the initiations. And I said, well, that's okay, that's very nice of you, but you know, I really don't think I want it. As I say, my personal connection with Culling continued, and I also helped them a little bit. They were very greatly chagrined because they were in 55, they were talked into appearing on television show KTTV with the then rather well-known interviewer around here, Paul Coates, on Confidential File, and they were to give a demonstration of a magical ritual, which they did. And you know how then the program was built, that here are a group of devil worshippers of Los Angeles, and this rather made them unhappy. So I then subsequently wrote an article for a magazine which was published entitled The Devil on Television. And I wrote up the whole case, how they were misled and really badly treated, because they didn't get a penny for what they did. You know, they thought that they would just get some publicity. Well, sure, they got some publicity, all right. You know. So that was kind of remained at that point. While a number of years later, I became acquainted with Dr. Francis Israel Regardi, who at that time, sort of in the 60s and the 70s, was, and in the very early 80s, was pretty much the main interpreter and probably actually a sort of apologist for Aleister Crowley. And Dr. Regardi and I became, well, if not close friends, but certainly friends, and I valued his company greatly, and he gave me many insights into the Golden Dawn tradition, as well as into the character and the teachings of the man with whom he had a very ambivalent relationship, but certainly whose work he publicized quite heavily in the latter part of his life. And if our time permits, I'll say a few more things about Dr. Ricardi later on. But of course our main interest now has to do with the individual around whom all of this publicity and so many ambivalent currents of thought constellated themselves, namely Edward Alistair Crowley. Crowley, of course, was associated with, for a considerable period of time in the early part of his life, with the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, and it was Israel Regardi's contention that everything that was good about Crowley came from the Golden Dawn. Everything that wasn't so good came from his own personality and its neurotic aspects, as well as from some other traditions. But that truly there was an individual here who had very greatly, just like all the other people, like Dion Fortune, and William Butler Yeats, and Arthur Edward Waite, and various people whom we discussed before. In addition to that, all of these people profited immeasurably by the training and the ambience of the Golden Dawn. The Golden Dawn, in turn, profited very greatly from several individuals and sort of seminal teachings and teachers of that time, one certainly being the redoubtable Madame Blavatsky, who was, so it would seem, rather grateful that some of her disciples back there in the latter part of the 19th century organized the Order of the Golden Dawn, which would be able to interpret the teachings of the esoteric tradition that she represented in a manner that would be helpful, especially to people in the West. And of course, in her early work, Isis Unveiled, she also wrote quite extensively about the magical tradition, inspired in turn by someone to whom honorable mention needs to be given, without whom really there wouldn't have been any Golden Dawn. There, a lot of things wouldn't have been without him, and that was the French magical writer Eliphas Levy, who died in 1875, in the same year that the Theosophical Society of Madame Blavatsky was founded, also the same year in which Carl Jung was born, and believe it or not, the same year in which Edward Alistair Crowley was born. So 75 was kind of a vintage year in certain sense. But certainly Levy's teachings, which he called by the umbrella term of magic, had a tremendous influence on the esoteric thought in the West at that time. We have also mentioned before, and many of you are probably aware already, that Eliphas Levy's teachings in turn also had a very great influence on General Albert Pike, the great Masonic authority and the founder and organizer of Scottish Rite Freemasonry here in America. Now, so the Golden Dawn tradition was already established. The Golden Dawn temples were established for about 10 years, when into the select and, well, I would say probably sort of spunky, creative group of the members of the Golden Dawn, of these Kabbalistic magician artists and intellectuals, there came in 1898 a curious and ultimately troublesome individual by the name of Edward Alistair Crowley. He was at the time 23 years old, recently a student at Trinity College in Cambridge, precocious and arrogant in the extreme, and good-looking in a mildly corpulent and bovine way. little did the studious and artistic members of the Isis Urania Temple of the Golden Dawn in London suspect that this young man would in most ways wreck their fine small organization, bring the subject of ceremonial magic into the open but also into some disrepute, and that indeed these currents of criticism and mistrust would swirl around the subject of ceremonial magic for at least 100 years and longer, and also that this gentleman would create a name for himself which became synonymous in many, many minds, whether rightly or wrongly so, perhaps we shall indicate a little later on, to countless persons as the embodiment of occult evil, which of course people were always willing to fantasize about. Crowley was born in 1875 into a family of brewers, which was able to reconcile this besotted trade with an avid devotion to fundamentalist Christianity in a sect called the Plymouth Brethren. His biographers say that his mother was wont to call him the great beast of revelations when he incurred her displeasure, which is kind of a heavy title to give to a younger little boy, you know. But, you know, these fundamentalists, they do strange things. They still do, actually, you know. And this circumstance may have caused his fondness for the appellation Great Beast, which in later life he made into his own, indeed his own most solemn magical and occult name, even using it in its Greek form. You know, things like that often sound so much more impressive when you can translate them into Greek or into Hebrew or into Sanskrit or something of that sort, as Homegatherion, the great beast. At the time of his entry into the Golden Dawn, he wrote poetry, novels, had a sincere interest in the arts and in the fine things of life. Yet greater than his aspirations toward becoming a true bon vivant were his aspirations for becoming a true magician. And thereby, as Shakespeare might have put it, hangs a tale. Crowley learned all things magical that were available, and much more, at the Golden Dawn, and he profited by it greatly. Dr. Israel Regardi, my late friend, who was at one time, for not a terribly long period, Crowley's personal secretary, wrote about this in his fascinating magical biography of Crowley entitled The Eye in the Triangle, which I trust is still in print, and it's really worth reading. And he wrote there about how Crowley's character was deeply influenced by the symbolic system of the Golden Dawn, and certainly for the good. As I indicated earlier, everything that was good, according and noble, in Aleister Crowley was in some way caused or stimulated by his experiences in the Golden Dawn. The Golden Dawn was his religion, his first and greatest opening into a realm of meaning and wonder, exaltation, and contact with higher, or as we now would call them, archetypal forces. What then, many would ask, went wrong? That is, of course, assuming that something did go wrong, and I am not entirely sure about that. But the answer to this is a difficult one, and it differs with the point of view of his biographers, many being of a rather hostile nature. And perhaps one ought to analyze somewhat which part of his activities were truly wrong and which were not. When all is said and done, many of the arguments used to prove the evil of Aleister Crowley go back to one thing, sex, the great S-E-X. Crowley struggled mightily against the sexual repression and, more importantly, the hypocrisy of Victorian and Edwardian England, and he adopted the strategy of a sort of flamboyant and zany flaunting of his liberated sexual views and life. It was not enough for him to live by his own standards, which many people did, but he felt obliged to let everybody know that that is what he was doing. As some of you may recall, there is sort of a Victorian little, I mean, I'm sure it is an ironic statement, that the attitude of the Victorian English, especially of polite society, was, regarding sexual matters, do what you please, but don't do it in the road and frighten the horses. Because horses rather than horsepower were still the main means of transportation. Well, Crowley really went out and frightened the horses. Moreover, he insisted that a person could be a sexual being and still work effectively in the spiritual sphere and achieve union with higher forces and higher beings, such as what in magic is often referred to as the Holy Guardian Angel, or whatever the Supreme Consciousness may be called. Now, one may ask oneself, is this truly as wrong as people made it out to be? And I'll leave it at the question. But I would also venture to suggest that on the whole, and there's a little aspect to this that I'll mention later on, but on the whole, I think Crowley would not have made a big splash at all with his sexual and sexual magical persona if he had appeared, let us say, in the 1960s or in the 1970s, especially in California. He would just have been one of a fairly large crew of pretentious swingers, let us say, who were in abundance then and who are not entirely absent now. You know? But, unfortunately, you know, this was the 1890s and around 1900, and that was a different matter altogether. However, there was another problem which really made things much worse, and this probably, to a large extent, was his downfall as far as much of the public was concerned. And this is another matter. And this other element may be defined as a trickster complex, or rather a gradually growing possession of his personality by what today we may call the trickster archetype. Now, I'm not here to give a big psychological dissertation of the trickster archetype. This has been done, and done very eloquently by various psychologists, particularly Jungian psychologists. But let's say just that keep in mind to trick, to bewilder, to shock, to horrify, to perplex. These were some of Aleister Crowley's favorite activities. Probably even more favorite than sex. He would never forego an opportunity to indulge himself in these kinds of exploits. He was the troublesome trickster at all times. Of course, that is not all he was. That needs to be remembered. He was a genuine seeker of God. He was a man of deep feeling and of formidable intellect. He was a fairly good poet and a learned Kabbalist. Now, he was, however, yet in addition to that, more than that. And this needs a little bit of explaining. As I have often indicated, one of the great difficulties, and indeed some historians feel the very downfall of the entire Golden Dawn, of the Order of the Golden Dawn, was uncontrolled and often badly assimilated psychism. The Golden Dawn was a fine academy of the esoteric tradition, both in theory and in practice. Very, very good. But There was one Achilles heel, which was really an Achilles heel of most of the members. And that was that as their talents developed, their individual psychism, their visionary and intuitive experiences remained uncontrolled and unchecked and caused all kinds of difficulties. This was also true of Aleister Crowley, but in a special way. And I'll tell you the story of that, because it was of extremely great importance to him. Maybe not to too many other people, but to him. In 1904, Aleister Crowley was on his honeymoon with his wife, the former Rose Kelly, sister of the famous painter and member of the Royal Academy, Sir Gerald Kelly. Rose was said to have been quite uninformed about Aleister Crowley's occult studies and about occult studies in general. She was a sort of society girl of superficial finishing school education, who certainly didn't know anything about spirits and ghosts and Egyptian gods and similar matters. Now, on their way back from Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, Mr. and Mrs. Aleister Crowley decided to remain for what in England would have been the unpleasant winter months in Cairo, in Egypt, where they lived in a hotel. In April 1904, Rose Crowley began to, incidentally, the name is Crowley, like a crow that flies in the air, not Crowley. That's how he pronounced it himself, so we might as well give him that honor. So Rose Crowley began to have peculiar feelings and intuitions to the effect that something of importance was about to happen. She saw vague and somewhat disturbing Egyptianate forms moving around in the hotel suite, which in view of the city and the country in which they were located wasn't really all that much to be wondered about, but she was taken aback thereby. She said to her husband, "They are waiting for you." Now, you know what? If somebody said that to me, I would bolt out of the place and never come back. Because somehow this idea of something or somebody waiting for me out there is very disturbing to me. I really don't like that at all. But Crowley apparently was more courageous than I am, which is possible and perhaps even probable. "So they are waiting for you." After considerable urging and persuasion by his wife, Aleister Crowley finally decided to yield to whatever force was about to manifest, and he sat for goodly periods of time in the living room of the Cairo suite, awaiting what was to happen. Well, the waiting ended on April 8, 1904, when he began to hear a voice which dictated a text to him. Thus on April 8th, 9th, and 10th, for one full hour on each day, not much more than that, and that's pretty controlled, I would say, for 1 hour each day he wrote under dictation or inspiration a small book, or poetic pamphlet, which he called the Book of the Law, or in magical Latin, Liber Al Vel Legis, which is the Book of Al, which could be Alpha or Aleph, you know, the first letter of the alphabet, or of the law. This document, which consists of 3 short chapters, purports to have been dictated by an entity, or as Israel Regardi calls it, a preter human intelligence named Iwas, A-I-W-A-S-S. Now, who was or is this Iwas? In the final chapter of the Book of the Law, the 7th line reads, "Behold, it is revealed by Iwas, the minister of Hur Par Krat." Now, Hur Par Krat would be a a particular form of Horus, Hur, you know. So a priest of Horus. Crowley, in spite of his usually quite intra-psychic orientation, which I gave you a little demonstration of what his interpretation of the ancient magical gifts, you know, and it's very, very psychological, very internal explanation, insisted that the inspirer of the Book of the Law was a personage outside of himself. This, however, really doesn't prove anything, because that is certainly one form which these kinds of phenomena frequently take. Crowley's own words about this are given by Israel Regardi in his truly remarkable magical biography of Crowley, The Eye in the Triangle. And it's just a short passage. This will be the only quotation of any length that I will share with you this evening. This Israel Regardi writing. Crowley's attitude, however, is entirely different. He is willing to admit that, in a sublime sense, he was the author of Liber 7 and another one, but that in no similar manner was he the author of the Book of the Law. The latter, he claims, was dictated to him as objectively and as audibly as if I were dictating this material to my secretary. He has in part anticipated this kind of argument. For example, in The Equinox of the Gods, he wrote, and this is now a quotation from Crowley, "Of course I wrote them ink on paper in the material sense, but they are not my words, unless I was be taken to be no more than my subconscious self, or some part of it, in that case my conscious self being ignorant of the truth in the book and hostile to most of the ethics and philosophy of the book. I was is a severely suppressed part of me." Then he added a footnote to the above reading, "Such a theory would further imply that I am, unknown to myself, possessed of all sorts of preternatural knowledge and power. The law of parsimony of thought appears in rebuttal." In other words, he you know, wouldn't accept that theory, that this somehow came from him. And Israel Regardi writes about it, "It can safely be said that current psychological theory would agree that any one person is possessed of all sorts of knowledge and power of which he is totally unconscious. Hamilton's law notwithstanding, both Freudian and Jungian theory are on the side of such an assumption, though the complete spelling out of each theory in detail would present a different picture. That I was might in truth be a severely repressed or dissociated or hitherto unknown element of his psychic structure could be confirmed by the fact that even to his death in 1947, Crowley is said to have found some parts of the book quite distasteful even to himself." That's saying a lot. So say I, not Regardi. "Just what they were, I would not know. Some other verses of the book relate quite clearly to material that he had once been consciously familiar with, but may have forgotten." Well, so much about Israel Regardi's view of the possible origins of the Book of the Law. Actually, to just the casual reader, stylistically it is not all that different from other works which he had written, although he thought so. It is fairly certain that Aleister Crowley had minimal conscious knowledge of the Book of the Law. Thus, in the second chapter of the Book of the Law, lines 75 and 76 says, "I listen to the numbers and the words. 4, 6, 3, 8, A, B, K, 24, A, L, G, M, O, R, 3, Y, X, 24, 8, 9, R, P, S, T, O, V, A, L. And it goes on asking, what meaneth this, O prophet? Thou knowest not, nor shalt thou know ever. Now that's a big help. There cometh one to follow thee, he shall expound it. But remember, O chosen one, to be me, to follow the love of new, and then he goes on, etc. Now, Aleister Crowley never had the slightest idea of what this referred to. The book makes dogmatic and great claims. Change not so much as a style of a letter, it commands. Well, one wonders whether this may be a gushing forth of elements of biblical literalism that he experienced in the religion of his parents. We shall, of course, never know who or what this I was is or was. Someone suggested that the name is in fact a disguise of the English I was. Difficult to tell. Thus we don't know who or what was responsible for the Book of the Law any more than who was responsible for Dion Fortune's writing the Cosmic Doctrine, or for H.P. Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, or for that matter of William Butler Yeats's Vision, all of these being either in toto or in part, you know, psychic productions, or Jung's Seven Sermons to the Dead. Certainly, at least in part, psychological explanations are most likely. At least this much we always have to keep in mind, that anything that comes, as you might say, through you, also comes to some degree and extent from you. And you cannot totally separate the channel from the material that comes through the channel. Because even if it should have in part or in total a point of origin outside of that person's psyche, it quite obviously comes through his psyche, her psyche. And that gives it therefore a certain coloring. But there is a very, very frequent phenomenon in people who feel that they are, maybe they are, you know, are psychic and are doing things of that sort, of very forcefully indeed, desperately insisting that this does not come from them. You know? One slight exception to that was Madame Blavatsky, who really attributed the sources of her writings to many, many different persons, many different phenomena and so forth, and who also insisted that people remember when they are they didn't call that, use that term at that time, channeling or mediumistically bringing forth the messages of spirits, that they themselves are spirits. Mm-hmm. And Madame Blavatsky tended to say, why are you so excited about bringing through messages from spirits when you have a spirit probably wiser and more powerful than those spirits right inside of yourself? How about addressing yourself to that? And while Crowley had very much the same kind of view in general, when it came to the Book of the Law, that was different. You see, that was different. Because it really grabbed him. It was sort of a big archetypal manifestation. More importantly for our purposes, of course, what is the content of the Book of the Law? Now, it is a book of singular poetic power, perhaps even more so than Crowley's other poetry or prose. Its content is obscure and seems to be directed primarily to the building up of Crowley as a prophet of a new age or a new aeon. Right there, again, I don't profess to know what this particular, the source of this particular scripture was. But in general, for all of us, when a psychic manifestation seems to have as the primary focus building up our ego, then it is suspect. You know, it is suspect, to say the least. And I think so is this. In the first chapter, he, that is Crowley, is called, I quote, the chosen priest and apostle of infinite space, the prince priest, the beast. I wouldn't mind being called all of those names with the exception of the last. The second chapter says, let the evil ones be cast away. Let the good ones be purged by the prophet. This follows the statement, behold, the rituals of the old time are black. In the same chapter, Crowley is addressed by the god Hadith in the following manner. Hail, hail, prophet of Nu, prophet of Had, prophet of Rahur Ku. Those are all Egyptian names. Also, needs to be kept in mind that, and this is not, does not necessarily detract, let's say, from the importance or the value of a scripture of this sort, that all these names are written in the manner in which Egyptologists at that time were wont to pronounce the names of the gods. Now they would be different. You know, a lot of these names are taken from Wallis Budge, who was the big authority at that time. Wallis Budge had been the curator of the Egyptian antiquities in the British Museum, and then when he retired, or maybe even before, he wrote a whole bunch of books on Egypt, Egyptology, and when you try to translate the hieroglyphics into a modern language, that's a difficult task, because to our great regret, voice recording, you know, no cassettes or discs were left by the ancient Egyptians for us to figure out how they pronounced these various words. People usually laugh at that, but you didn't, so that's quite all right. You know. In any event, you know, that also, let's say, sort of dates the material just a little bit. So, then it goes on saying, now rejoice, now come in our splendor and our rapture. I am the master, thou art the holy chosen one. This is all rather uplifting for Aleister Crowley. Lift up thyself, for there is none like unto thee among men or among gods. Well, now that's a pretty big statement. Lift up thyself, O my prophet, thy stature shall surpass the stars. They shall worship thy name, four square, mystic, wonderful, etc. Ay, ay, ay. You know. In chapter 3, he is repeatedly called, O blessed beast. And detailed instructions are given him as to how to proceed with his prophetic ministry, particularly how harshly he should deal with his enemies. Them that seek to entrap thee, to overthrow thee, them attack without pity or quarter, and destroy them utterly. I wonder how he would have even gone about destroying anybody utterly, you know. Swift as a trodden serpent, turn and strike. Be thou deadlier than he. Well, again, it's a little, you know, some of us would suspect something called ego inflation. Now, the book of the law is composed of three chapters, each ostensibly dictated by another deity. Chapter 1 is the manifestation of Nut, usually pronounced N-U-T or N-U-I-T, from whence perhaps the French word for night, nuit, is derived, the well-known and very ancient Egyptian deity, the star goddess of the night sky. This is really the most benign and lovely of the texts. Crowley's sort of Crowley's supernal anima or great mother archetype speaking. The second chapter is ostensibly dictated by Hadith, who is the masculine counterpart of Newt. Unlike Newt, Hadith is pretty much unknown to scholarship. He is identified with Harpocrates, the silent horse, who stands like this in the hieroglyphic picture, you know, don't say anything. The third is Horus in his aspect of Ra, Hor, Khut, and that one is the toughest and the nastiest of the lot. And this particular god seems to have a strong dislike for all other gods and for other religions, and has some pretty insulting things to say about Moses, about Muhammad, and about Jesus and everybody else. Incidentally, from these disclosures, Crowley also deduced that there are three great ages or aeons: the aeon of Isis, the aeon of Osiris, and the aeon of Horus. And the age of Isis would be long past. Probably in terms of zodiacal ages, it might be identified with the age of Taurus, you know. Then the age of Osiris is passing, you know. And the age of Horus, of the conquering hawk, the conquering divine child, is coming. The Book of the Law is a bombastic, poetic, angry, inflated treatise, full of sound and fury, signifying, if not exactly nothing, at least not all that much. Its tone reminds one of Nietzsche in his most bombastic mode. And Nietzsche was very popular at that particular time. Many interpreters have called it demonic and have felt that from now on Crowley was on a devilish track headed for some sort of hell. Well, I think that's, again, a bit of an excessive judgment. One thing we need to remember, that no matter what role he may have assumed, he still never ceased being the magician. Magic was his religion, and it remained such. He never rid himself of the heritage of the Golden Dawn. And indeed, this fact kept him reasonably sane, in spite of Aivas and his much-touted new law and new aeon. Yet even the Book of the Law contains some valuable admonitions. For instance, here is one. Be strong, O man. Lust enjoy all things of sense and rapture. Fear not that any god shall deny thee for this. Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. Good counterweight to fundamentalism and things of that sort. I mentioned the aeonology, or the doctrine of the age of Isis, the age of Osiris, and the age of Horus. In this age, the age of Horus the child, the emphasis shall be on will. Will. In Greek, telema. Do what thou wilt will be the whole of the law. Love is the law, love under will. The first part of which sentence is derived from Rabelais, whom obviously Crowley felt certain kinship with, who articulated it, fais ce que voudra, thou shalt do what thou wilt. When I first discussed this with some of my original Crowleyite friends, like Louis Culling and others, they all seemed to be saying that the will here is not meant in the sense of capricious willfulness, but rather man's true will, the human being's true will, which ultimately is the will of God. Somewhat like Rollo May, the psychologist, in his famous, once very famous book, Love and Will, speaks of two kinds of will and intentionality. And will being the personal, the lesser will, intentionality being the higher will. This is not without merit. somehow, you know, reaching conclusions and making deductions from the total corpus of Crowley's writings, I am convinced that he did not mean a sort of childish personalistic cultivation of willfulness, but that he was alluding to something greater than that. In 1912, Aleister Crowley met a German occultist named Theodor Reuss, who was the head of a German order loosely resembling a sort of fringe Freemasonry. Now, what we need to keep in mind is that then and now, in Europe, in some other countries, Latin America, for instance, you know, there is a great, well, how should I put it, a great diversity in Masonic traditions. And some of the smaller and fringier sort of offshoots of Freemasonry bear little resemblance to the serious and highly integritous and moral tone of Anglo-Saxon Freemasonry that is in England and in America. So this was one of these fringy things that sort of had a relationship to Masonry. It was known as the Ordo Templi Orientis, Order of the Eastern Temple or of the Temple of the East, a variant on the name of the Order of the Knights Templar. This order was founded in 1902 by another German named Karl Kellner. The rituals of this order are known and may be judged by their content, and upon comparison, I would consider them to be trivial when compared to the rituals of the Golden Dawn. Crowley took a great interest in this organization, and Theodor Reuss soon made him the head of the order for the English-speaking countries. Of course, there weren't too many members. Thus began Crowley's sort of main career as the head of an independent magical order. Now he didn't have to worry about the Golden Dawn adepts anymore, whether they were still around or not. He had his own show. And what was it that attracted Crowley to the OTO, we might ask? It is fairly safe to say that it was sexual magic, or Saturn magic, as it was called. Now, what can we say about that? Well, probably not an awful lot, because it would become a little too explicit. But I remember when I questioned Louis Colling about this, he sort of said, look, this was at least one statement of his. He said, it's quite obvious that no matter what they do or don't do otherwise, people are going to have sex. Well, I said, you know, I was about 25 when I was talking to him. I said, yes, Louis, you're right. So I said, now then, inasmuch as they are going to have sex, why not combine it with something lofty? Why not combine it with something magical? And he says, that's all it is. It's trying to give sex a higher purpose. So again, sagely, I nodded and I thought, oh yeah, that sounds like a real good idea. But ultimately, he said there are really three levels of this kind of magical practice. This is simplified from the OTO teachings. He said, it starts out, number one, the first level is abstention. Well, let me tell you, that is probably a level or a grade that not too many people want to be stuck in for too long. The second is a solitary sexual magic. Need I say more? The third is often called Dianism, as Louis Colling called it, and this is, well, let's say, heterosexual sexual magic. Crowley also, in his grade system, eventually, I guess he was being probably pressured by various people, he also instituted what is called the 11th degree, which is homosexual magic. So he was quite ahead of his time, you know, very much ahead of his time. So then I asked my friend, I said, Louis, it's fine, but you know what? What's supposed to be the result of all of this? And so finally he came out and said, well, one of the frequent results is what he called the creation of a magical child. Now, the magical child is not a human baby. A magical child is a spook. The magical child is a kind of an elemental being. And I said, well, okay. And then I said, you know, some of us have tried very hard not to have any children, with success, I dare say, in my old age. And I dare say it with some pride. but let's say, okay, then what are we going to do? What are we going to do with these magical children, you know? Are we going to have a magical nursery or something? As the closest I could come to it, I understood it as these are sort of animated elementals who or which can do their magical parents' bidding. See, so you'll have like a little magical servant in the house. Now, if we could train them to wash dishes and a few other things, it might be quite all right. But seemingly that was not their purpose. But I tell you, I think I have seen one or two. And you know what? They are not very enticing critters to have around. They don't feel good, they don't look good, they don't smell good. They are not something that I would exert myself a lot to have around. But anyway, that's one. And another one is the prolongation or other effect of the sexual magic is supposed to be prolongation of life, health benefits, and so forth. Well, I don't want to go into too many more details, but let's say, is this stuff evil? No. The worst I can say about some of it is that it's silly. But evil, no. It sort of reminds me of another late friend of mine who at one time, for a much briefer time than these others, was an OTO member. People who were around San Francisco, particularly in the 60s, would know him. He was the famous Joe Miller. He was a very, very fine gentleman. Every Wednesday, you could find him and his wife at a certain spot in Golden Gate Park. And then Joe would lead a walking meditation for a couple of hours in Golden Gate Park. Everybody knew him. He was also the president of the San Francisco Lodge Theosophical Society. Heck of a guy. He even looked like a magician, you know. A gaunt face with a little goatee, you know. And so I asked, so Joe said, oh yeah, sure, he says. So I joined the OTO. And then they were giving me the big secret. You know, the big secret was sex. He says, you know, I was already about, this was during the Depression, I was about 30 years old, you know what? I knew all about sex. I didn't need to join an organization. That was his point of view. He said, you know, well, in any event, as I say, it's, that's probably a judgment that one may have of this particular matter. However, I need to add something here. After having read a lot of Crowley's material and having known some of these people who were part of the original OTO and their, you know, their friends, and incidentally, I must say these people like the late Mr. Culling, Mika Aldrich, some others, they were interesting people. They were all sort of artistic bohemians, but cultured people. They not only knew their magic, but they knew a lot. They knew good poetry, they knew music, they knew art. They were cultured, interesting people. I'm saying this in contrast to, let's say, the quality of some of the people who are now in the OTO. But So I, as I say, I was intrigued by Crowley, and I particularly I liked some of his poetry, and I still do. He is listed in some of the reference books as one of the minor Edwardian Victorian poets and all of that. But sort of my greatest disappointment with him did not come about until about the year 2000, by which time I had, you know, read and studied a lot of his stuff. Because at that time, there was published in England a book entitled OTO Rituals and Sex Magic by Theodore Royce and Aleister Crowley, edited by A.R. Naylor and Peter R. Koenig. And in it are a lot of OTO rituals that never before have been published. And when I read through all of them, I came to the conclusion that every last one of them had in elaborate, symbolized and poetic form as its center sex. Every last one of them. Of course, Crowley rewrote all the rituals of the OTO. But each and every one of them had, as its center, has a sexual content. And I said to myself, you know, this is crazy. To make so much out of a basic human, let's say, psychophysiological function, and to build such an incredibly elaborate poetic framework within which to place it. This is really something that in this day and age I am not interested in. And that was sort of my judgment on that score. Now, as our time moves on, let's say, what can we say in terms of an evaluation of Crowley? Because my judgment on these OTO rituals is not identical with the judgment on Crowley himself. First of all, there is no doubt about it, he was a genius. Learned, but somewhat unscrupulous. Egotistical, but not mercenary. Now, at least that you can say about him, and this is where I think this is his great virtue when contrasted with so many people in a later period and in the New Age. Crowley never made any money off of his magic. He inherited a nice little fortune from his parents, who made it in the brewery trade, and then he spent it. Much of it is spent on privately publishing his magical books and things like that, but he certainly was not a mercenary person. Maybe somewhat unbalanced, but by no means mad. He was an experimenter and a dabbler, but also somewhat of a prophet. And as indicated before, he was above all a trickster, delighting in terrifying and shocking people. And nowadays, practically nothing that he did or that he talked about would shock people particularly. What was his view of magic? You might say he was on the right track, especially as evidenced by some of his lesser writings, like his introduction to the Lesser Key of Solomon, which I quoted from at the very beginning of our talk. I think his poetic magic was very fine, and he had, I think, a very commendable central idea of magic as a transformation of self. So, as one might say, should we condemn, should we burn Crowley? I don't think so. There are reasons for concerning ourselves with Aleister Crowley. The first of these is that he was a 20th century shaman. He had all the faults and the few virtues of the shaman. He demonstrates for our consideration what shamanistic pursuits can do within a modern and essentially Western setting. Secondly, Aleister Crowley is a major figure on the literary horizon today as an authority on magic, on the Kabbalah, and on the Western esoteric tradition in general. He can no longer be ignored. One may not approve of him, but one cannot ignore him. Third, Aleister Crowley has become, largely by his own design, and this is somewhat waning now, the shadow of Western occultism. What does one do with the shadow? Now, of course, we are reaching back to Jung here. One deals with the shadow by bringing it into light, one redeems it. And I think that's what needs to be done with Aleister Crowley, and that is what, to some extent, we are doing right now. Fourth, Aleister Crowley has made an original contribution of considerable importance to contemporary Kabbalistic literature. There are some of his books which are unique and which no serious Kabbalistic student can do without. One is Liber 777. Another one is the Book of Thoth on the Tarot, including the Tarot deck that he helped to design. And it was designed on the basis of his instructions by an artist, Lady Frieda Harris. So a little bit similar situation as with Arthur Edward Waite. And it's a beautiful artistic deck. Do I advise anybody to use it for divinatory or other purposes? Well, not really. Not because the devil is going to jump out of the cards and get you, but rather because they are too complex. Crowley's tarot cards are, the major arcana particularly, are much more like, how should I put it, instruction devices in which he tries to teach his philosophy. That's all well and good, but that is an objective very different from the objectives that one looks for in a deck of tarot cards for divination or even for meditation. And so it's they're beautiful artistic cards, and if you sort of want to get an idea of Aleister Crowley's mind and his symbolism, you can certainly do that by looking at the cards. Also, another book of his, Vision and the Voice, is, I think, also very direct and very interesting, and it has to do with the use of the Enochian keys for certain evocatory activities and experiences that he had primarily in the Egyptian desert, once again. Now, some final thoughts on Aleister Crowley and a little bit about Israel Regardi. Crowley died in 1947 in England, and his already somewhat depopulated organization, the OTO, soon fell apart. In the USA, a brilliant individual, our fellow Californian Jack Parsons, and his lodge of Agape in Pasadena on South Orange Avenue continued Crowley's works throughout World War II and for some time thereafter. There was also a branch of the same OTO in Hollywood on Winona Avenue, but neither of these two buildings stand any longer. They have been torn down. Jack Parsons died in an explosion of rocket fuel. He was an inventor of such substances and had a major crater of the moon named after him because of his merits with rocket science. So he was a very brilliant and very well recognized man, one of the early founders of JPL. But of course, the source of his creativity was magic. I might also just mention, by way of interest, without going into any details at this particular time, that one of numerous individuals who were attracted to Jack Parsons and his lodge in Pasadena was a man who came here from Arizona by the name of L. Ron Hubbard. As we say in Latin, sapientiae sat, enough of that wisdom. We shall not say any more, but we shall maintain, as Buddha was wont to, a noble silence. My friend Louis Colling, of course, was part of the organization too. There were several successor or revival organizations formed over a period of time, mainly with the upsurge of interest in the occult and the esoteric in the 1960s and the 1970s. In England, the occult writer Kenneth Grant had a mainly paper organization, OTO. In the USA, in the 1960s and 70s, a former Navy officer, Grady Lewis McMurtry, who was personally acquainted with Crowley because he was stationed in England at a certain point during the war and visited him quite often, revived the OTO, and that is the only organization that is not only in existence now, but that is actually flourishing, is usually referred to as the OTO Caliphate. At one time, Grady McMurtry was challenged by a Brazilian occultist named Marcelo Ramos Mota, but that challenge didn't amount to anything. The OTO Caliphate prospered, survived McMurtry's death in 1985, and to my knowledge is now led by someone named William Breeze, who goes under the magical name Himenius Beta, having followed Mr. McMurtry, who was called Himenius Alpha. Now, perhaps of much greater influence ultimately than any of these, however, was mainly in a literary capacity Israel Regardi. Regardi was born in 1985 in New York. He died in Sedona, Arizona, around 1980. I had still a letter from him a couple of days before his death. Before that, for several decades, he lived in Studio City, where he practiced Reiki and psychology, and he also had a chiropractic license. Another noted New York psychoanalyst and my fellow Hungarian, Dr. Nando Fodor, said to me about 1960 that Israel Regardi was the best lay analyst on the West Coast, lay analysts being psychoanalysts who are not medical doctors. I met Dr. Regardi around 1970, about the time when I began lecturing at the Philosophical Research Society. He wrote a lot of books. The earlier ones, which were later on expanded, were The Rituals of the Golden Dawn, which were the first time that anybody had published the complete secret rituals of the Golden Dawn, and Israel Regardi, who had been a Golden Dawn member, had been criticized for it quite severely, but his excuse concerned Aleister Crowley, because he said Crowley had published a lot of the Golden Dawn rituals, but always modifying them according to his own ideas, so they were not authentic. So Dr. Regardi felt that the actual authentic form should be published, which he did, wrote all kinds of books. He had a private temple in his house where he had all the ritual implements of a Golden Dawn adept, including his Enochian chess set. If you can imagine what that is, they also had to make their own chess sets, which were combined with the, a sort of mandala system that has to do with Enochian magic. Enochian magic, by the way, just very, very quickly, is a system of invoking some very obscure and curious entities that was discovered in the times of Queen Elizabeth I by Dr. John Dee and his friend Edward Kelly, and which, among other things, involved the use of a completely previously unknown artificial language. Whole language. Well, you know, that's no proof of big spirit origin either, because the late J.R.R. Tolkien, for instance, in his lifetime, I think, wrote about 4 or 5 complete artificial languages, including Elphic and a few others. But the Enochian, it's called Enochian because they felt that it relates to the experiences of the prophet Enoch with the angels and the entities that appeared at that time to the magicians Dee and Kelly said that they were angels. And some of this Enochian magical practice was integrated into the Golden Dawn. Well, I have to quit pretty soon. Let me put it this way. Unless you are very experienced and very trained magician with considerable psychological insight about yourself, I would say leave Enochian magic alone. I have seen several good people really rather badly damaged thereby. And by the damage I mean, I don't mean that their hand fell off or something like that, but psychologically damaged. It's something very, very weird. Again, I don't mean that it's evil, but it's the sort of thing that has a very strange and very powerful unconscious effect. Dr. Regardi, however, felt that if you were strong enough and if you knew how to do it, you could practice Enochian magic. In any event, Regardi was the great writer on this subject, not only of the Golden Dawn, but then also on Crowley, because while he met Crowley, he became his personal secretary early in his life. He had a bad falling out with Crowley, which was very easy to do because he was a very cantankerous sort of personally a nasty individual who didn't treat people very, very well. But Regardi was greatly impressed by him, nevertheless, and he sort of tried to come to terms with who Crowley really was to the end and kept writing about him. When I asked him one time, well, who are the people whom you admired most? And Dr. Regardi said, Blavatsky, Crowley, and Wilhelm Reich. And his most admired organization was the Golden Dawn. His lesser loves were Mary Baker Eddy and C.G. Jung. It's quite an eclectic company. But let's say Israel Regardi had a great deal to do with bringing Crowley into the open and into attention in the 60s and thereabouts. Again, I don't want to badmouth anybody, especially anyone who is still active and alive, but let me say that the rather widely spread and numerous OTO caliphate, in terms of its rank and file membership, is a far cry from what I can see from the old OTO. You know, certainly not possessing anything resembling the odor of sanctity. So I think Aleister Crowley would be somewhat unhappy in that regard. However, in the leadership of the OTO caliphate, there are some very learned and very intelligent people. Crowley can never be figured out. The people who have tried, you know, all ended up with very one-sided judgments and very imperfect opinions. The present kind of mythos about him seems to be that he was a neo-pagan, he was something like a more learned and more Kabbalistic witch, that he was a violent opponent of Christianity. You know what? It's not true. It's not true. Let me tell you a little incident that went on for several years about him when he was in London, oh, maybe a few years, 7-8 years before his death. He attended every Sunday an independent Catholic church, the bishop of whom had occult inclinations, of a bishop by the name of Monsignor James. Crowley was there every time. He knelt at the consecration, he took communion, and he was very happy. And he said, there is no difference between this and my Crowleyanity. If you want to look this up, you'll find it in a book which is a biography of a man named Vivian Deacon, who was a very interesting fellow from Australia and New Zealand and then settled in England. It was written by his daughter. And Vivian Deacon was an associate and a friend of Aleister Crowley. So, you know, he had many sides and he had many interests and he was able to integrate them, I think, all. He was a much more complex and more flexible soul than most of his present-day followers imagine. He would surprise them all and might anger some. in his own autobiography, sort of magical autobiography, which he wrote, and it really ends on a sort of somewhat discouraged note, because it was in a period of his life when his work was sort of declining. He said, when I was initiated in the Golden Dawn, the name that I received was Perdurabo, which means I shall endure. And he says, indeed, I will endure even unto the end. He did. And I think that many of the valuable and important discoveries that he made have survived him. They have endured, and they are still enduring, and they will endure until the end. One doesn't have to be perfect to make a serious mark in the esoteric tradition. And he did. And I think for much of the good, much of the wisdom, much of the learning that he has left for us, we must be grateful. There are aspects that maybe we don't, are not quite as grateful for, that we don't understand, that's a different matter. But therefore, to him also, we render thanks. So thank you very much.
Copyright MMB III by BC Recordings, catalog number 301405. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.